Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Jerry Friedman, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Nicole Gardner. Jerry, we've used the term public human services. Can you elaborate exactly what that means?
Well, there's a debate, actually, on what public human services are. At one point, it was human services that were provided by government employees. But I think that that's changed a great deal with privatization efforts, with partnerships, with contracting. So now we define it more as services provided under the public aegis, where government dollars are used and there's a level of accountability, but it could be provided by a number of different associations, organizations, companies, both private and not-for-profit.
Let me go back in time a little bit. In the 1990s, government had made a statement to end welfare as we know it back then, which launched a series of welfare reform initiatives. Could you remind us of some of the key elements of this welfare reform? And from your perspective, how significant a social policy change does this welfare reform effort represent?
If I look back on events that happened in my career, I think welfare reform was probably the most significant change in social policy in my lifetime. And what it did basically was that it ended individual entitlements for people and gave states block grants with considerable flexibility for states and local governments to design programs that made sense to them. Included were some provisions like time limits, lifetime time limits, work requirements, just a vast array of significant changes to the way that we looked at what had been a dependency program to one that became a program of self-sufficiency. In many ways, I think some of the lessons that were learned through welfare reform are really beginning to permeate some of the other human services systems as well. But all in all, I think welfare could be considered a successful program in the United States that brought about significant change.
So, Jerry, in that context, tell us a little bit about some of the key lessons we learned in welfare reform.
Well, first, if I could just talk a little bit about some of the successes. And you have to realize that the AFDC program had been in existence for many, many years. It was a well-entrenched program, basically operated through federal rules. And so when the new law came into effect and states were empowered to develop their own and design their own programs, there was a great deal of both apprehension as well as a great deal of high expectations for welfare administrators who had really wanted to do something different with the program for a considerable period of time. It's important to note that welfare reform didn't actually start with a new law. There were over 40 states who had gone to the federal government to seek waivers to say, we think that we have a better solution to helping people become self-sufficient. And what the federal legislation really was were some of those common threads through all of those various waiver programs. But when you look at what happened over the course of a decade, there was a 60% decline in welfare caseloads in this country. Child support collections for non-custodial parents doubled. Over 1.5 million welfare recipients who had previously never been attached to the workforce had gainful employment and were no longer reliant on the public welfare system to support them. We implemented a national electronic benefits transfer program, a large computerized effort that actually eliminated food stamp coupons in this country. We created hundreds of thousands of child care slots. We invested in prevention programs that resulted in a decline in teen pregnancy among welfare mothers of one-third. And for the first time, reversing a two-decade trend, we actually had a decline in child poverty rates in this country. So by all accounts, you would consider that a success. Well, there were many lessons to be learned through that. First, there was a really compelling case for change. Welfare dependency was a bad investment strategy, basically supporting somebody. It didn't help grow our society or our economy or the self-image of those that were receiving those benefits. So that we learned that there was kind of both an economic and a moral imperative for change. Yes, indeed, we are a compassionate society. We are our brother's keeper. But on the other hand, we had an obligation to help people maximize their own personal potential and develop their own capacity. We learned that personal responsibility can be very effective public policy, that in life there is a quid pro quo, that reciprocity is just the way that we live as Americans, and that its public policy should reflect that. We learned that people can rise to the occasion, that when they were afforded the opportunity, people became job ready. They invested. when there were both incentives, positive and negative, people reacted in it that they did want better things for their families. We learned, I think, that the best service delivery was designed at the local level. Welfare reform was not a national strategy. It was saying, here's the money, here are the resources, develop a local strategy. And that resulted in those successful efforts. We learned that we had to rely on partnerships, that welfare in this country couldn't be fixed by government. It required corporate America, the business community, the nonprofit world, the faith-based world, education, all coming together in kind of a uniform strategy to help address this. We learned the importance of services coordination and integrating services. What happened with lifetime time limits was that the bar was raised. We had a finite period of time to have people become job ready or they would lose this safety net. We know that people don't come to welfare offices simply because they have empty wallets and empty pocketbooks, that there's often just a myriad of other problems that exist, and that we needed to address those. And that required the agencies that provided those services to get together in some kind of coordinated strategy. We also learned that there were other multiple strategies that we needed to look at. Asset building, predatory lending. You know, there's a whole industry that thrives just because people are living in poverty. I think the most important lesson, though, was, you know, for years people railed about the public welfare system, and I was one of them, to be honest with you, that it was a failed system. Well, what we learned was it was failed policy. When people are penalized, when their family condition, their economic conditions are worse off because they're trying to better themselves and become employed, when they actually lose money, when the most responsible thing that they can do financially for their family is to stay on welfare rather than try to get to work because they'll be worse off, that's failed policy. When that changed, we demonstrated it was not a failed workforce. The welfare system, this huge entity in this country, literally turned on a dime. Welfare offices almost overnight were transformed from welfare offices to work centers. You know, the message was clear. What can I do to help you get a job today? This magnificent welfare workforce absolutely transformed themselves because they wanted to. They saw firsthand every day how just handing somebody a check and food stamps and hoping that every problem went away was foolish policy. And when that changed and they could make a real difference, they really rose to the occasion.
That's quite a story. So you mentioned a few minutes ago reauthorization. So where are we with the reauthorization of TANF and kind of what's the status? Where are we going?
TANF was reauthorized after about 12 or 13 continuing resolutions. We just couldn't seem to get congressional attention because of all of the other priorities. And at the very end of legislative session last year, as a part of the Deficit Reduction Act, TANF reauthorization was passed. As an association, we are very concerned about the kind of micromanagement that's been built back into the welfare system. We think that the broad strategy of providing goals for states to reach and empowering communities to reach those worked, clearly demonstrated that. And so we're concerned that we've taken a huge step backward when it comes to welfare reform. And administrators, rather than talking about how can we get people into gainful employment, how can we help them get better jobs, how can we improve their economic conditions, they're talking about how we can have something count as a work participation credit because of the penalties that they're going to be facing. We're working very hard to minimize any damage as we see it to this program, to continue to empower states. We strive for maximum flexibility, but we're going to have an uphill battle.
Now, Jerry, you mentioned earlier that welfare reform really began at the state and local level. And I believe today we again are seeing state agencies developing innovative public policy agendas to shape the next decade of service to low-income families. Could you elaborate on some of these innovative state programs? What are some of the strengths that you're seeing in some of these programs?
Well, again, I think drawing off some of the success that we had with welfare reform and just looking at a public policy that empowers communities, we're seeing this play out in the child welfare programs. We're seeing this play out in healthcare programs. If you went to a Medicaid director 20 years ago and you said, what is your job? They would say, my job is to pay bills timely, accurately, and efficiently. And basically, they did that. If you ask a Medicaid director today, what is your job? Well, they're part of a governor's health cabinet. They're looking at universal coverage. They're looking at strategies to cover the uninsured. They are looking beyond just paying bills with public child bills to what are the best treatments and interventions that we can provide? Where do we get a return on the investment? How can we engage consumers? How can we embrace prevention and wellness programs? It's an exciting time right now because of a lot of flexibility that's been given to states around healthcare design. And I would contend that the real leadership for this is not happening within the confines of Washington, D.C., but it's happening in the state houses throughout the country. I think the same is true welfare. Welfare administrators are saying, you know, if I could take the resources that it takes to buy foster care and invest in strategies to build stronger families in the beginning, investing in prevention, investing in interventions that help people become better parents up front, then we could save all this money on the back end. But more importantly, children thrive better in families than they do in foster care. It's more than intuitive. It's supported by all the research and by all the evaluations that happen. So what I see happening now are administrators throughout this country, states approaching the federal government just like they did with welfare reform, saying we think we have a better solution based on our local conditions, by the assets and the resources within our community, and our ability to mobilize them. The other thing that we didn't have 25 years ago when I was running programs is we have more supportive technology. It used to be very hard to keep track of all of the records that you needed and the requirements and the rules and regulations when you had 6 or 7 or 8 different categorical programs with rules and different requirements. But with computer systems now and the ability to process information, it is much easier, I think, to manage those programs within the compliance rules of the federal government.
So, Jerry, it sounds like, you know, really workforce strategies are really sort of the key to success here in helping families manage this transition that you describe. But can you give us some – perhaps some specific examples of programs that are out there that you think are really innovative and are working well?
Well, there are thousands of them. And I think, again, the key was that public administrators were set free to go out and to develop strategies that worked. You know, one of the things that we used to do – I used to do this when I ran welfare programs, was to go to corporate America and to business and say, wouldn't it be nice if you hired somebody off the welfare rolls? You know, it helps the community and it's the right thing to do. Now we can go to corporate America and the business community and say, we can help you build your business. We can help your bottom line. We can help your profit. We can do that through tax credits. We can do that through customized job training. We can do that through extended medical assistance coverage and child care subsidies. We can do that through working with new employees to help train them through orientation. So people see this as a better business strategy than they used to as just a social service.
So it's about collaboration.
It's about collaboration. It's about partnership. But it's also it's about investment. Good public policy, good social policy, good human services policy, and making profit don't have to be mutually exclusive principles.
That's a very good point. What emerging technologies hold the most promise for improving human services delivery? We will ask Jerry Friedman, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.